Hello and welcome to Hacks and Flacks with me, Petri Hoskin. Hacks and Flacks is the only series where you'll get the inside scoop on how journalist hacks and the flacks of government and business work behind the scenes to decide which stories you'll be reading with your morning coffee, and perhaps more importantly, how they keep certain headlines off the front pages. What happens if a public figure is a subject of a salacious story? When does a scandal make or break a career? And how do you really know what is or isn't fake news? All these subjects and a whole lot more will be explored by me and a regular panel of hacks and flacks, ready to spill the beans and tell us how the sausages get made. Flacks like former government advisers Giles Kenningham.
Hello.
And Andrew McDougall.
Hello.
Plus hacks like Mick Booker.
Hello.
So now all the gang's here, let's delve into the world of hacks and flacks.
You know, it's the only people who know can leak it, really. I could get access to that privileged information. Sometimes I do, but I never publish it unless it's a case of there is a, say, it's like there's been a huge fight, one of the star players isn't playing, everyone's going to be shocked. Then I think that is a time when you can do it.
Hello and welcome to another Hacks and Flacks, which promises to hit the back of the net, as this week we explore the similarities between how the news gets made in politics and sport. And putting their jumpers down for goalposts today, our regular panellists are Andrew and Giles. Hello.
Hello.
And we're also joined by someone who's already our man of the match, sports writer and journalist, Nizar Kinsella. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Nizar, now you've recently moved from online journalism to the more traditional genre of Daily News with the Evening Standard. That's the wrong way around, isn't it?
Yeah, I think, but I was at a newspaper beforehand as well, so, you know, I've been jumping to and from. I was at the Daily Mirror before that, and, yeah, so I've tried a bit of both sides, and, yeah, it was kind of an honour, actually, to come back as a reporter, because before I was kind of a desk man, as we call it, and now I'm a fully-fledged sports reporter, football reporter, really, yeah, at the Evening Standard.
Which one's better?
What, online or newspapers?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that, like, the freedom of online is quite good because there's no column inches to fill, so you kind of, like, you have the complete freedom, but then the weight of having the newspaper gets you access, gets you respect and things like that. So I feel like, for me, I needed that move just to go down maybe the more traditional route, maybe hone myself as a reporter. And like, you know, online, I was one of the most experienced guys in the room in terms of reporting, but now I'm around more experienced guys that I can absorb stuff from, so that's kind of why.
So you needed to fill your contacts book?
Yeah, I think so.
It's a handy way of doing it, isn't it? So are you more selective with the newspaper then? Do you go bigger?
Yeah, I kind of have less freedom of my own subject, so I have to almost pitch it in and have to win the pitch over with my editors, whereas before I kind of was the editor and the reporter online. I think that that's quite common in that space, but now it's like, come on, guys, choose my story, do this story. I kind of have to really push it and convince them.
Is that a quality thing, though, right? When you have the infinite scroll and infinite space of online, like, did you ever find yourself or others kind of slipping into just feeding a beast and churning stuff out, whereas now you say, okay, I've only got a few hundred words. Yeah. I got to make this count. It's got to be a sharp news line. Does it make you better?
I think it depends on your model. I think the goal where I used to be, that was kind of like niche subjects, so I could kind of work in the margins. And I guess with newspapers, you kind of have to be right on the zeitgeist, and then that's where the real difference is. You have to be, you maybe right into a less educated audience almost in the newspaper. It has to be like layman's terms, you know, Evening Standard, anyone could pick that up, couldn't they, at the tube station. So that's kind of like, I feel like that's the difference. And I found that transition quite hard in the beginning because I had to sort of, you know, as a football obsessive myself, I know some ridiculously niche subjects within the sport. So I had to like rein myself back and go, look, these are the top subjects at Chelsea.
Do you find, I always sort of struck me by how quick the turnaround times or the deadlines are
for matches, do you, beforehand, have you kind of got an infrastructure or you've mapped out, you know, without knowing the result, kind of, because you're having to write as you go, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think I kind of live the job, like, all the time, so it's just, it's constantly in my thoughts, like, sometimes even before bed, I unfortunately think about football, and it's kind of like, I'm just
lucky fiancé.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Maybe, yeah, she's not going to be happy listening to this. Yeah, so it's kind of like, I think that that's kind of how it is, but yeah, there is a sense of that, like, what if this happens, then we write about this, and that's kind of the approach that I often take to games.
Do you find yourself writing two or three versions throughout the game?
That's the frustrating part of the job, yeah. And especially with dramatic games, I mean, I did the World Cup final, right? So I was at that game,
wow.
And like, there was a point where I just sort of was like, I need to just stop writing and just experience it, because this is also a once in a lifetime opportunity, but also have to output something under pressure. So it's kind of like, I'm just going to leave it, and I'm just going to have to be really, really quick once the game's kind of done. And then you go to penalties, and that's probably one of the hardest things to write. Yeah,
I bet. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, there's been said that there are comparisons in the way that sporting organisations, certainly such as FIFA,
yes,
which some would say is incredibly political anyway,
yeah,
and the political world deal with the press. What's it like to deal with the organisation? You're the press side of it.
Yeah.
How do you deal with those organisations to make sure you get what you want?
Yeah, it is a hard part of the job. You're always thinking, and unfortunately, how stuff plays, you know, who you're upsetting, like your tone. And there's so many competing interests in football, you know.
And money,
yeah. And that's kind of the interest, really. But, the governing bodies themselves are kind of at war at the minute. We had the Super League debacle, but then there's, like, FIFA versus UEFA. Can we get more World Cups out of this process? Maybe there's a sort of racism scandal or, you know, authoritarian regimes that are being preferred by certain organisations. We've seen where the World Cup has gone in recent years. There's been a lot of criticism about that. And there's huge sensitivities as well, and it's so easy to upset people. I mean, football almost is like a proxy war at times for regimes.
And it certainly is political.
Yeah.
It's become more political. Though everybody says, let's keep sport out of politics, it's very hard to tell the difference sometimes.
Yeah, I think it's impossible now. Like, you look at the ownership situation in the Premier League. Manchester United's maybe going to be going to a Qatari owner. That will frustrate certain people. But, you know, our economy's gone down that route as well. So you kind of find yourself between these tension points and kind of, I guess all you can do is kind of tell it through your lens, and that's kind of your job, is to experience the world, maybe have some kind of educated and privileged access to football, and then kind of, you know, just input your views and try not to be influenced.
I'm interested, though, and it's the same for you two guys, for Andrew and Giles, is how you stay honest when you've got, you know, you've got people to please. And that's a really difficult balance, isn't it? If you want to tell the truth, but you don't want to upset somebody who might deny you access, what do you do?
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, I've been shouted at, you know, people have tried to intimidate, you know, journalists time and time again in the football space. We've seen journalists banned at Newcastle completely and things like that. So it's just fragile.
Alex Ferguson refused to speak to the BBC famously for years, didn't they, after they did a story about his son being an agent and allegations around that. Do you think things like The Athletic, Amazon Prime, do you think they have sanitised their coverage for access? Yeah. Are they selling out?
I think that rights, the kind of difference is kind of the rights holders versus, I guess, organisations like mine, newspapers, and I think that rights holders are pretty sanitised. I mean, you even have a case of the Premier League that itself is like a media organisation that serves their content, and it's very sanitised in my opinion. And actually, if all the content was like that, I think football fans would be very frustrated. I think we all experience the sport through, I think the most authentic conversation we have about the sport is through WhatsApp, through our WhatsApp chats, and when our friends are making fun of us for losing at the weekend. But then, you know, people do talk about really serious issues, like your owners are these guys, or, you know, your player's done this, but we're all forgetting about it. There's kind of a sense of that, and I think that that's the authentic conversation that, as reporters, like, we should try to report like. But I think that broadcasters, you know, including Sky Sports, they can't quite, you know, deliver.
I love the behind the scenes stuff, but to your point, it doesn't capture those huge swings in emotions, the highs and the lows that most football fans go through, right? Yeah. And that would be what you want to see, because obviously as a team, they're probably going through that, whether that's reflected in the team talk, people being dropped, bust ups on the training field, players being transferred.
Like who's shagging who's wives, you know, like all that stuff.
It's all that stuff.
Well, I find All or Nothing quite, the documentary series, I don't really like it, I must say. Like it's become almost like a cliche, and there's just a lack of access.
Have you seen one of them where you thought, that does not reflect reality? I was following that club throughout the season, and a completely different story was going on.
Well, that would be the test, wouldn't it be? If you were like, say, Chelsea had agreed to do All or Nothing this year or last year, which would have been a bananas with sanctions, switch of ownership, new owners. Yeah. Like, it would have been perfect tableau for stories.
Yeah.
But I'm sure shit. Like, they
all
would
or
not
nothing,
want.
Just for those who might not know, that's a documentary series, isn't it?
On Amazon Prime.
They go
Amazon
behind
Prime.
The scenes with a team for a full year, and they give you kind of 10 episodes of how the season was. You asked about, how do you treat people that need you for access?
Yeah.
And in the political side, it was always my view that, you know, don't hate the player, hate the game. And if a reporter had a story that was bad for the government and they reported it, I couldn't get angry at them for reporting something that was true.
Yeah.
If they, however, had something that was incomplete or incorrect and I could show that to them and they still went with something, which kind of rarely ever happened, then you can get upset about it. But I'm not going to get upset at a reporter doing their job. Will I go to them with my next exclusive? Probably not. Or maybe I do because I want to see if I can turn the relationship around and make them sweeter. But I can't get angry for somebody having something right. If they have something right and we're to blame and we're at fault, then that's the way it is. And you shouldn't. But I doubt that.
But there are
egos
at play.
Sure.
I mean, in politics and sport. Yeah. I mean, you know, famously male, famously egotistical.
Yeah.
So you dent somebody's ego, maybe they're not going to give you a ticket to the big game. They're not going to give you a backstage pass.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's Andrew's right. I think that as long as people are letting you tell the truth, and then I think that then you have like a sense of understanding, even if people are frustrated with you, maybe digging up something, like a sense of at least that the truth can get out. I think that's the most important thing. And I think it always does get out as well in football. I think that there comes a point where reporters maybe outlast the people who are shouting at you, or, you know, players especially, like they come and go. So it does give reporters a bit of power, really, because they kind of have that sort of staying power over, you know, many people who work at clubs.
But there's also like trade secrets and stuff like that, or competitive advantage. If you think, like, if you knew something about a Chelsea player who is carrying an injury and you report that, that gives the team they're playing that weekend, or maybe it's a race for fitness, an advantage, because they can change their setup, change their tactics, change their approach.
That's one area I don't really get involved in, actually. That's become a huge thing, especially on social media now. There's a lot of leaks of lineups, so it gives the other team an advantage. I remember Chelsea had...
Who's leaking?
I think it's going to be people, either family or the players directly, maybe the ones who aren't playing, saying, oh, I'm not playing, and you can piece it together from there. Family, maybe agents, people, you know, it's the only people who know can leak it, really. And I could get access to that privileged information. Sometimes I do, but I never publish it unless it's a case of there is a news interest in there. Say it's like there's been a huge fight, one of the star players isn't playing, everyone's going to be shocked. Then I think that is a time when you can do it. But I think that unless it's that kind of situation, then I wouldn't leak a lineup.
Is that different online to a paper, per the early part of the conversation? Like, do your editors at a paper just go, I don't really care? That's kind of like, that's like if you have all the room on the website that you have, you can kind of write 100 words on this or 200 words on that.
I think it's more the other way around, actually. Okay. I think that the paper might be more interested in that subject. I mean, the England team often leaks, doesn't it? So, and it's usually it's not the online brands really doing it.
What, tell us about the role of agents, because they come under fire a fair bit. They have their own reputational issues.
Yeah.
Is it fair? You know, are they scandal ridden? Was it very variable? And are they blocking access? Do they lie to you?
I think that I think I have a lot of sympathy with agents, actually. I think they're a bit undermined a bit too much. I don't think it's such a scandal ridden area. I think there is maybe an issue around youth recruitment where families are being paid money to go with one agency over another, and maybe not necessarily that would be best for them. And I think that there needs to be regulation a lot more regulation, I guess, like a lot of areas. I mean, it's almost completely unregulated, but most of the agents I deal with, there are a few exceptions who have been quite criticised in the media, actually. I think that, you know, the majority do have a role to play. I mean, you wouldn't say the same of Hollywood agents, would you? So I think there is a role for that. And I think also what our agents, they are just... they're just representing the talent. Yeah. So they're almost an extension of the player, and the player doesn't have the legal knowledge and things like that. If you're going to be a millionaire and you've never had money before, it is quite useful to have somebody like that, or a lawyer, or people like that. So I think that if I was a footballer, I would have an agent. If my son was a footballer, I'd want them to have an agent, and I'd want them to have an agent that I work with and trusted. But at the same time, I'd be constantly challenging that agent about why you're doing this. What's that reason? Are you too close to the club? Are you kind of working both sides here to try and get favour for someone else? That kind of thing.
So most of your stories come through them, vis-a-vis the press office of the club?
I think they're important. I think for certain type of reporters, yeah, agents are quite important, I think. Some reporters don't really deal with them, but I think if you want to be somebody who breaks transfer news, which is really important, a huge market, actually, in terms of reporting in football, in the football space, that's a key concept.
Would you consider somebody like a Fabrizio Romano a reporter? They don't have an outlet, they don't write, that's basically a Twitch stream and a Twitter feed with millions upon millions of people. And I just, as the layperson football fan, I just go, okay, agents are briefing stuff because they want to move markets or gin up demand. And an editor would go, well, I can't publish that in a newspaper because it's somebody's agenda and you have to challenge that.
Yeah, I think that maybe sometimes, maybe his working for himself gives him that freedom to sort of work like that, but you know, if you keep doing that, if you do the favours, then you get the exclusives as well. So it's kind of like why he's been so successful as well. So there's obviously space for it and a market for it. And maybe it's an unusual world where maybe working for yourself is more lucrative than working for an organisation, almost any organisation. And that might be, you know, his situation, having been sponsored by Heineken and things like that for transfer deadline day. Imagine a sports reporter at the Daily Mail or the Evening Standard being sponsored by Heineken. You just wouldn't happen. It would be the organisation themselves. So that's what's kind of happening there.
Every club has their what the kids call the ITK, the in the know accounts, that seem to be able to put stuff out that looks legitimate, or half the time it they've seen the rumor somewhere else and have just repeated it and then claim victory when it actually does come true. But how much time do you spend actually sifting through that world and trying to understand, are they credible? Do they know stuff?
Yeah, I think that you just have to constantly be engaged. I mean, it all seems to play out on Twitter, maybe increasingly Instagram as well. So you just have to be a little bit across that conversation. Sometimes there is truth in those things. I mean, probably the problem is what I think clubs should be a bit careful of if they want to control their messaging is that young players, they get followed by people with a lot of social media followers. They want them to like them, you know, these influencers on their platform. That influencer can maybe promote them and stuff like that, and they think that's important when they're young. And then they end up leaking loads of stuff. So I think that that's actually why I follow that conversation, is because stuff sometimes is quite accurate, because, you know, it's leaking inside the club, because, you know, the football clubs are unique in that there's maybe people who are 16, 17, 18, and they have, like, they see a lot of things and they have a lot of influence and they're worth a lot of money, and probably in no other organisation that happens. But for me, as a reporter, I would always feel uncomfortable approaching people who are in their teens. I just think they're not developed enough. It's quite good that there's a structure around them to protect them. And if I was, you know, working on the club side, I would be like, look, we really need to protect these guys, because it's really tempting for them to just reply information on Instagram and they could also get exposed and that could damage their careers as well. So I kind of feel like that's how it all emerges. But then that's how things get out as well.
Because we'll often, when we talk to clients about how to contain stories or shape stories, it used to be a lot easier when there were four walls around an office or a building that kept information out and kept information in.
Yeah.
And now to your point, that you can take an Instagram post of a player who's maybe out of the lineup at a club, who posts some kind of cryptic saying. You know, I can think of a player at Chelsea who's not in the squad that's been doing that. And you see who else in the squad likes the post. And you get an image of who's onside or who's not, or even a player's wife. Yeah. Another Chelsea example of kind of being a news story just by a public platform that has nothing to do with the club. Yeah. And how do you deal with that? And I mean, it must be a goldmine for you. You can just sit there and kind of
kind of, yeah, it's important to look at it, but also not to draw too many conclusions and actually ask the questions. So it's sometimes your subconscious, sometimes it catches you at your worst point. Like you could like a social media post and that's kind of how you're feeling after a disappointment or something like that, but it's not reflective of a broader issue. So I try to be quite balanced in that and try to have proper conversations that kind of balance it out. You know, you could just go with it whatever way the social media is flowing, but I think it's important to have actual conversations.
One of the things with football is that the notoriety or the fame of a player often comes off the pitch. Yeah. The behaviour of footballers, certainly in the past, not that long ago, will push them onto the front pages for all the wrong reasons. Do you try as a reporter to report just the game, or do you find yourself having to go down the sewer sometimes?
No, I think that what the usual tension is that they're on the front page, but it wouldn't be my story that puts them on the front page. So I think
you're the back pages.
I'm the back pages. So I think the sports reporters are quite comfortable like that. But then often you find your player maybe is on the front page, and then that person is angry with you and it's not really your story or anything like that. Particularly, I think tabloids have this problem where they sometimes report on players, highlight their maybe infidelities, you know, a lot of it's love life, stuff like that, and then they feel unfairly treated, or there's maybe it's not quite right or something like that, or not quite reported in the right way. And then that could damage your access or your relationship to that player, and it's through no fault of your own. So that kind of thing happens quite a lot. But it's not, certainly, yeah, I don't think the Evening Standard goes down that route too often with the...
But if you heard something about a player and you knew that they had done something, you know, salacious, possibly wrong, would you give that to the reporter for the front page, or would you write it yourself?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I think that it's not really something that's happened to me too, I don't think ever maybe, but it's something that I think I would have to like really stand it up, really have proof, and then maybe I'd work with somebody in the reporting, you know, the news reporting team, just because it's their bread and butter day to day, and you know, maybe even hand it over, you know, just to get my byline off it. But you could do
and
that.
If it was a mate of yours? I mean, reporters make friends, right? That's what happens. You know, you make contacts, they become friends. You find out something about a friend who's a player. Is it still a story?
Yeah, I think so. I think you'd have to report it, but maybe you'd hopefully not make friends with those kind of people that do the bad things. But I think you'd have to report it, wouldn't you?
But you get, I mean, we've talked about some other episodes, you get less kiss and tells now because of privacy, right?
Yeah.
You know, with the Ryan Giggs story about, you know, him having multiple lovers, that probably wouldn't make it into the press these days. Yeah. With the John Terry allegations about him sleeping with a teammate's girlfriend. Yeah. That wouldn't make it into the papers these days, would it? Because of privacy.
Yeah, that's true.
The public interest. I mean, even, I suppose, the story of Kyle Walker the other week, the England Man City player getting pissed and sort of revealing everything to the world.
Taking his stick out of the club, you can say it on
that was like, because, you know, he was, I suppose, technically breaking the law, right? Technically. Yeah. But I mean.
But not the club rules, according to the club statement.
Is that right?
Apparently, you don't
see. I mean, obviously, footballers have got to be a lot more careful now, because, you know, you used to hear those stories that, you know, Tony Adams would say, you know, after training they'd go for 10 pints.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, now everyone's got a camera phone, so it gets captured. And it would be on social media, right, within 30 seconds. But I mean, conversely, those salacious stories, which would have been on the front of the News of the World, that was what was shifting papers, decade, right? That was the bread and butter.
Yeah.
You don't really see. So, a bit like we were saying, you don't get many political kiss and tells. You don't get so many football kiss and tells, do you?
I think it's very hard, you know, to even go down that route. I mean, the kind of places they go, maybe reporters used to go as well, didn't they? And now the money gap is so big. Well, yeah, you could afford to go in that place, right? But now it's like the high-end clubs in Mayfair are probably not the places that I hang out and stuff like that. So that's maybe part of it, that you're kind of out of that world. I mean, I was you know, this is not naming any names, but I know where some of the richest and famous go around some of the football clubs in London. And if I was to go in that place, I would stick out like a sore thumb and wouldn't enjoy myself and things like that. But
I'll have a glass of water, please.
Yeah, exactly.
Tap water? Tap water? Do you have tap water?
I've seen the footballers on the beers and stuff like that, and it's not, you know, I think that you've got to let them let off steam and be relaxed, because, like you say, the camera phone, the environment they have, I think there is a reasonable sense of privacy that people should be allowed. I feel sorry for the youngsters now that they can't go out and like maybe go on a date.
That is the main thing. You don't get the kiss and tells, but you get them out on the lash, don't you? Yeah. In Las Vegas, in Mykonos, getting pissed up.
But we've seen Jack Grealish, haven't we, in Vegas, like drunk
Harry Maguire
and stuff like that. Yeah.
Greece, you know, and when people bust up out there. And
it's actually hardest for the reporters to report on these stories in a way. You almost want somebody to leak it if you want to report the subject, but you almost want somebody to capture the footage, leak it on social media, make it a massive conversation, then it's unignorable by the club and the club release a statement about it. That's almost how things come out now, because you can't be the eyes everywhere they are, and people will film the footballers when they go out.
I just want to ask you this. How much do you think money has ruined the game? Because you've got clubs who we know sort of make huge offers for players and then say, oh, we're going to pay it over 10 years because, you know, then it's not coming out of a one-year budget. Yeah. You see these young players with massive wealth.
Yeah.
It must turn their heads. It must change who they are as players fundamentally.
I think it does. You often find that when the money comes, they get worse. So a player will get paid too much, and their hunger will go, and that's the unfortunate truth. I mean, it could happen to anyone. I mean, I could get overpaid, and that could happen to me.
I'd love that.
Let's test that theory, everybody.
And I'm never that angry about it. I mean, you see the decline of certain players, and it's got to be a factor. I think it is often it's sold to me as a major factor around when young players decline.
I mean, just look at like players like Dele Alli, who was like the future and is still a young guy, and just completely. Gone.
Well, they were only 40 grand a week or something.
More than that.
I mean, you know, he was a Spur, so it might have been 40 grand a week. But, I mean, how could it not? I'd love to sit here and tell you it wouldn't go to my head, but, if you're 20 years old on 100 grand plus a week with kind of wine, women, and song everywhere you turn, like, I'd like to say that I'd be a saint through all that. But also maybe the money disciplines them in a way, knowing that there's so much at stake. That's better to go home, play video games, eat your boiled chicken and vegetables and stay fit and not kind of...
Yeah, some of the guys are quite boring like that they do just sort of stick it out, go home, play the computer games, and you're like, you're not really living a life. I mean, I've been travelled around the world and things like that, and most of these guys just go to Dubai every year just because there's reasonable privacy, like high-end hotels and things like that. But I get to go out and, you know, maybe go to Japan on holiday or around, you know, Italian islands and things like that, and they don't get these privileges. It's like, you know, almost don't envy them in many ways. Of course, they'll have a great lifestyle and their families will be richer for it. But I think that there is a very claustrophobic sense in the footballer's circle, and they're always keeping that social circle very small to try and protect themselves from stuff leaking out about them. The ones that don't have stuff leaking out about them generally have smaller networks and things like that, which is the only way they can manage it.
There's nothing the Hacks and Flacks team enjoy more after a lively record than relaxing with a delicious beer. And as we're a generous bunch, we want you to get in on that action. And so we're offering you the chance of grabbing a free case of craft ales from Beer 52. Yes, you can claim a free case of exceptional beers by simply going to www.beer52.com/hacks and cover the meagre postage costs of £5.95 to claim your free case now. Each month, Beer 52 send their members a case of unique and varied beers from a different part of the world, which includes their ever-insightful Ferment magazine, where you can learn about the breweries, regions and the wonderful world of beer whilst enjoying a phenomenal selection of fresh and tasty craft ales. And as fellow newshounds, I'm sure you'll love learning what's new in beer as much as we do. And there's also a couple of delicious snacks to enjoy too. Also, if dark beer is not your thing, you can choose the light-only case. And even if, after all that, you're still unsatisfied, you can simply pause or cancel any time. So why not join us for a drink and sip along while you listen to the next episode of Hacks and Flacks by going to beer52.com/hacks to claim your free case now. That's beer52.com/hacks. Cheers.
If there's one thing that every hack and flack can agree about, it's that in a country of 330 million people, it's incredible that the race for the White House is again coming down to a battle between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. I'm Simon Marks, veteran Washington correspondent for a whole array of global broadcasters, and I hope you'll check out my podcast, Simon Marks Reporting, for regular updates on all aspects of life in America. That's Simon Marks Reporting, wherever you get your podcasts.
What's the difference between dealing with Premiership clubs in England when it comes to sort of covering them?
Well, I think that what's changed really is, well, the money. Like, I think that they've got a sense that almost that media organisations, competitions now, they've got the club websites, they want maybe people going instead of going to the Daily Mail website, to their own website. If they offer interviews out, could they not do them themselves and control the message a bit better? There's a lot of that going on. A lot of sponsorships as well, so instead of Access going to media organisations, they're going to like brands like Chelsea, sponsored by Three, so they do like a content series for them. And I think it's quite common across many clubs that they'll have like Access built into the contracts and things like that. So yeah, I think that's where a huge shift's going, and that's what makes reporters' jobs harder. I think every year I've done this job, it's got progressively harder, and partly it's down to the money side of things and all that sort of thing, and the online space as well. It's all this sort of monetization of content and it not being journalism, and it's sort of almost turned into content.
Yeah, the sponsors, though, because like you said, there's so much money involved, and they will therefore, with money comes power. Mm. How much power do these companies have over your reporting?
I'm not really seeing an example yet of the companies themselves, just because, again, they kind of come and go. But maybe in future, if you get into the point where you really have no access and you're really reliant on those companies, then yeah. But there have been, I guess, where the power sometimes lies is I've sometimes had interviews which are like connected to a brand, and you kind of have to give them a mention, and they're like, don't talk about this subject, don't talk about that, don't talk about this. And you're like,
that's shocking.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like, do we agree? And you kind of maybe measure it up, like, is it worth it? So it's kind of like, where do you draw the line?
Do I remember a footballer turning around a sponsorship bottle? Yeah.
Wasn't that Ronaldo? Was
Ronaldo,
that
I think.
Yeah, Ronaldo, yeah. I think like, Pogba, I don't drink Coke.
Oh, that's right. But he stopped them from getting the advertising.
Yeah,
but I mean, but think about it this way. If you're, so look at Chelsea, so very famously last year, you know, rich Russian oligarch with no commercial imperative to run the club. It's been run for his id or for his pleasure. Now American private equity backed firm comes in, pays $4.25 billion, I think it was, in total for the club. They're not going to want uncertainty around the project or the brand, or what the players say, how they represent the club. They'll try to, A, they want better commercial partnerships to get a return. They know that these clubs are media platforms far greater than any one news outlet, to Nizar's point about them having their own channels to kind of put these controlled messages out. And so people like Nizar are the fly in the ointment to telling that story. And so why wouldn't you, if you're them, try to throttle that down? Yeah. And it's like, it's in some ways more power than political spinners could ever have, because, you know, society needs government and the challenge function of reporters to function.
The only disadvantage,
football's football.
The disadvantage for them is, and it's happened to me a few times where I've been to a match and like I've not had any access, and it's like, well, I could just write my opinion now. Whereas if you gave me one of the star players to come out, then he would sort of dictate the agenda, and I think that's rightly so. I think if football, we want to hear from the stars, but also talking to independent people, and I think that that's. But that's also a way of the club to control it. Maybe if you have like a captain to come out after a defeat and go, look, it wasn't good enough, blah, 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 but we're all going to stick together. And then that kind of dictates the agenda. But where you completely shut out the media, then maybe that sometimes empowers the media to just say, look, this is what's going on. It's not good enough, blah, blah, blah. This is my voice. And you don't need that player's voice. And I think that also the pandemic showed that, because the pandemic was a great almost reining in moment of access where a lot of clubs went further away from the media. Everything went digital, everything went on Zoom. There was kind of maybe a disconnect, and I think that's not come back to the pre-pandemic levels as well. So, but then I think a lot of media were empowered as well by that period where they were like, actually, people do want to hear reporters, especially in football. A lot of reporters have a lot of social media followers, more than footballers, because what the reporters are saying about the club is more interesting than what the players are saying about their club. So I think that there is another tension there that kind of works maybe in the media's favour, is that a lot of reporters are being listened to and people enjoy what they're saying.
I just mean, think about it, to draw the political parallel. It'd be fascinating, you know, in government, any government, there are people who are in favor and there's people in the party who are out of favor, and the people who are out of favor love to go to the media and shout about it. Now imagine in football, if, like, to your point, the captain comes out and says, give a good effort, and then, like, you know, number 18 on the bench who's not going to sniff it comes out and goes, we're fucking shit. And we're, like, basically does Antonio Conte and go, we're shit, and he didn't try hard enough, and I should be playing. Like, imagine how great that would be.
I'm just thinking how great it would be if MPs were sponsored.
They are.
But I want to wear, I want them to wear, you know, a Nike badge or something.
Huawei.
So I would say to that point, it's easier for you covering England then, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is it easy covering the England match? To some extent, you've got less vested interests. It's just more straightforward. You haven't got so many sponsors and different sort of stakeholders to have to keep happy. And
it is, yeah. I think it's the national team side of things is more wholesome end of football, where it's kind of like the reason they're doing it, it's a lot simpler. They're doing it just for their country. And then England as well, a bit of a standard bearer at the minute with sort of access to players, building the relationships. There was that period during the golden generation where there was a terrible relationship between I think everyone sort of understands this and knows this, terrible relationship between the media and the players and the general organ that was the FA that runs the England national football team. But now they've kind of built that relationship really well, and it's become like a sort of standard setter. They always play darts famously before their press conferences with some journalists and stuff like that, so I could play darts with a player or whatever, and then it kind of breaks that boundary. You do this.
Is that to keep it off the WAG and all the personality stuff that you saw with kind of the Beckham era, where it was really about, the camp in Germany and look at all the wives, and so they figure, we'll give you some darts, and that way it's about what's on the pitch and not.
Again, imagine darts in the house.
I was like, who are the WAGs now? Like, I don't even know. Like, do they?
Yeah. Also, I think there's that down to.
I couldn't tell you.
I mean, I think Southgate's an amazing media performer. He's very accomplished. Yeah. Be a good politician, but you know, he's like very relaxed. You never really see him flustered. And to your point, you know much more than me, but it seems like there's quite a settled relationship with the media, isn't there? Mm. You don't hear about many bust-ups, falling out. It's less about the sort of salacious goings on off the pitch as well, and maybe that comes down to, I don't know, good set of players, the culture he sets, I don't know. I mean,
I think there was one bust up between Raheem Sterling and Joe Gomez, and it was reported on, so it's not like people are passing up opportunities to talk about bust ups, but they're few and far between at the minute. I mean, the guys are quite a young squad, they're quite easy to control, I think, and they're quite focused and believe they can win, and maybe when you believe you can win, you're more disciplined, and you realise you have to be right on it.
When you're at a press conference, and I've covered a few, they're achingly dull mostly.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen anything that has tickled you, or you know, was shocking?
I mean, I remember an Italian reporter came over, and he was kind of pretended he was a reporter because he worked for a TV channel, but he was actually a comedian, and he presented Antonio Conte with a Man United shirt because he was having a great big argument with Jose Mourinho at the time. It was really, which was a really nasty argument through the press, which was quite fun to report on, but you were like, these two guys are really going at it here. I mean, there'd be a 0-0 against a like lower league team in the cup, and you'd be like, oh, my paper aren't going to want anything here. And then they'd just go and have a go at each other, you know, and then it's like, well, great, this is brilliant. Yeah, you could use this for that kind of, battle between the two of you all you want. And it was great fun. But, I think that was, you know, the comedian doing that was one of the ones that stood out. But I remember telling Frank Lampard that he got a really tough draw in the cup, and he was like visibly really annoyed about it when he was the manager of Chelsea, and it sort of creates those viral videos, and because the cameras are all reporting it, like if you do something silly or get shouted at or something, it could go viral.
I heard there was that Harry Redknapp sometimes would stop press conferences halfway through and go, all right, lads, can we go off the record here?
Yeah.
And you know, had that kind of, but was quite well liked, you know, he was the kind of king of the doorstep, but
Yeah, that's
quite sort of, I suppose, you know, what press conferences, when could you normally do that? Yeah. You know?
I think that's real confidence when a manager can do that, and real trust, and that's a relationship building. Harry Redknapp was at Tottenham for a long time, and I think that's to their credit, really, that they can trust them. They want to give the truth, or at least say what they want to say, and I think that's what it's about, really. And that kind of, I think that's quite good. I think some other managers do it. Generally, the English ones or Scottish ones, you don't really see the Europeans doing it, but Thomas Tuchel, he was a master of it at Chelsea. Yeah, and he was great. Yeah, but Mourinho's the best I've ever seen.
What you mean for the drama?
Yeah, the drama, but also just using the media. I mean, the greatest press conference I was ever sat in was Jose Mourinho. Chelsea beat them 4-0. He was Man United manager, and he said Judas is still number one, and then he went on a rant for like three minutes, and then there was no time for any other questions, and it was just like he'd already set the agenda.
I think that the media training has killed the political interview, right?
Yeah.
It really has. Is media training in danger of killing the sports interview?
Is Graham Potter really that boring?
A lot of the managers are.
I think some of them are just not that entertaining. But yeah, I think with the players, I think, yeah, media training has been pretty terrible. I think they're almost deprogramming themselves, actually, though. I think there's a counter-reaction where, and I think this is where agents come in, so I'm going to talk them up a little bit, is that they realise that the club wants to sanitise the message, but they've realised that, you look at it on Twitter, Instagram and all this kind of stuff, you don't build a following unless you speak in your authentic voice. If you can, human beings can sense other human beings not being authentic.
I mean, it kind of might be a bad parallel to draw, but it's like, that's why Boris and Trump were so successful, because people didn't want the sanitised sandwich.
They actually
wanted to have that, like you say, a bit of edge. Yeah.
Marcus Rashford was where he almost deprogrammed the media train and then was like, right, I'll go on the attack for an issue that I care about. And I think that people looked at that and thought,
My better half is a television journalist and kind of hard news, and can't stand when we watch football, period. But afterwards, when they're doing like the media interviews, and she's like, she just starts mouthing the lines before they even reply.
Yeah.
She's like, oh, it was a hard match. We'll take it one game at a time. It's like platitude after platitude. And
it's got to the point where people have just stopped using it as well. Like, there's a lot of people just don't show up to the interviews. Yeah, I mean, there's some great ones. Jack Grealish, I was lucky enough to spend time with him, and he's absolutely sensational. Always makes eye contact with you, like talks to you as if you're just a man in the pub, and you know, acting out his stories. He wants you to be entertained and laugh at his jokes and all this.
Let's hope that is the death of the media training, because I think it does kill, just kills conversation. Just to round things off, let's have a look at the world of sports PR. Which sports story, past or present, was an own goal?
Well, for me, quite recent one was Romelu Lukaku doing his interview with sort of an unsanctioned interview around Chelsea, but he was unsanctioned, did an interview complaining about his treatment, not playing enough at the time, you know, how the club handled him, kind of making excuses for not playing as well as he should be, and he probably thought, oh, this is gonna like look really good, play really well, but he just ended up looking like a spoiled brat, and
Ronaldo.
As a Chelsea supporter, I can tell you, it was like one of those things. Yeah. It's just, it was not appreciated by anyone.
He annoyed his employer, which, you know, they were on the record about, so I'm not revealing anything there, but he annoyed his agent. He didn't involve the people who look after him. He had media agents and stuff like that. They weren't involved. So it's just like, why do you hire all these people around you if you're not going to
seek
their advice? You know, yeah, it was a bit like
exactly
that.
Hire experienced PR professionals.
But I think the problem with football is that the fans matter. You know, if they don't like what's going on, it can negatively affect performance. It affects your bottom line, and that's probably affected his bottom line. It affected Chelsea's. The team suffered for the rest of the season, and now he's gone and doesn't want to come back. But he still has, I think, the biggest contract at Chelsea, so they have a problem to solve in the summer or whenever he comes back.
And what about Ronaldo, who used the media to get out, it seemed, to get out of a contract?
Well, I think he thought he was doing it. He did well initially, but then the only offer on the table is Saudi Arabia, and you could argue they've offered him a great contract, so maybe he's happy with it. He's acting like he's happy with it.
Then he rocks up and says he's happy to be in South Africa.
And also, that worked out great for Manchester United in the end. Piers Morgan did them a favour, because they're a much better team without Cristiano Ronaldo. And I think that's clear. So it's kind of been a blessing in disguise.
What about you, Giles?
I want to take one from the world of tennis. So Nick Kyrgios, I think, who was the kind of John McEnroe of his era, sort of his biggest strengths, his biggest weakness. You know, he's, I like him because he's free-flowing. He will sit in press conferences eating his sushi, just having rows with journalists. It's very funny, but has that kind of, you know, he wears his heart on his sleeve, but it goes too far, and that temper tantrum is becoming tiring now. But people like him because, to all our points earlier on, like in the world of sanitized, you know, Federer, Djokovic, great players, Nadal, but they're very straight down the line. You don't really see them sort of break out into emotion, whereas he's like, you know, he only plays for half the year, right? Because he can afford to. I like that kind of individual style. Mm. Whether he'll be able to sustain it for a long time, though, I suppose that's the issue.
For me, as our touch on the Super League debacle that happened, and, you know, for people who don't follow football, there's basically an initiative that some of the top clubs in England, Spain, and Italy to sign up to a Super League where the top teams would play each other a lot more, and the fan bases just freaked out, particularly Chelsea's fan base, and kind of protested in front of the stadium. And it was one of those things that it just shows you that there is a rational discussion to be had about the need for something like a Super League. If you look at the way football's going and the amount of money that's coming into it, like the $4.25 billion for Chelsea, United will sell for something similar to that. These people know they can't make a good return on that if it just sticks to the same formulas now, where in the Premier League, yes, you do play other good teams, but more than half the time you're playing, you know, teams like Bournemouth, who people won't get excited that your team's playing. And people want to see the best playing the best. So they want to see the Spanish clubs playing the top English clubs, and not just in the Champions League, where the draw means that they might not play each other anyway. So if you're looking at the amount of money, so there is a case to be made for doing that. That's good for fans. You could do a revenue distribution, you know, but they, instead of trying to kind of prepare the ground or explain that, they basically just hired a PR firm like the weekend before they jammed the last clubs into the agreement, did one briefing, and then didn't speak to it. And then it all went sideways within an hour or two. And now it's maybe off the table forever, but probably not, because the amount of money in football. And so it's just one of those things that, you know, and even if you think about English football, the fact that an organization like the Premier League can't get their officiating right and explain their officiating and how VAR works, and there's no accountability for having referees having to explain their decision. You have £1 billion product being undermined by technology and like inefficient application and an inability to explain motive or rationale. So I guess it's just to all the people involved in football, you still have to speak and communicate and give your rationale and your motive for doing stuff, because it's the only way you can get something done.
Yeah.
Well, there's no extra time for this match today. That's all that we've got today. Thank you very much indeed to Andrew McDougall, Giles Kenningham, and Nizar Kinsella. Thank you so much for joining us, Nizar. That was really interesting. No need to take shirts off and swap, though. We'll stay exactly how we are. We'll be back next week, so be a good sport and join us then. Goodbye for now. Hacks and Flacks is presented by me, Petri Hoskin, produced by Amanda Redman, and brought to you by Trafalgar Strategy. If you want to get in touch with your take on the current news climate, you can do that by emailing us at hackflackpod@gmail.com. And don't forget to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time on Hacks and Flacks.